Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Timon of Athens, Act 1. An untirable and continuate goodness. The poet, the painter, the merchant, and the jeweler marvel at Timon's ever-flowing beneficence and command. In Act 1, Scene 1, our first look at Timon comes to us through the eyes of people who benefit from him. They have built around him a circle of flattery, shallowness, and self-deceit. To borrow a line from an REM song, they are, quote-unquote, shiny, happy people holding hands, basking in the radiance of Timon's golden fortune. We hear the views of a poet, a painter, a merchant, and a jeweler. None of these men seem to think they are taking unfair advantage of Timon, but in truth, they're taking him for everything they can get. They're probably no better or worse than many others in their professions, but they're FOT, friends of Timon, for the money, not for love, even though the merchant declares Timon, quote-unquote, a most incomparable man, breath, as it were, to an untirable and continuate goodness. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 30 through 32. The jeweler has an exquisite, precious stone that he would like Timon to have, at the right price, that is, quote-unquote, if he will touch the estimate. Act 1, Scene 1, line 15. This merchant has a way of being frankly commercialist and yet elegant in his praise of Timon. The painter displays his creation intended to honor the gracious Timon, and the poet duly praises the, quote-unquote, artificial strife or craftsmanlike effort that must have gone into its making. Act 1, Scene 1, line 38. The poet alone seems to have a bit of depth. He gives us the darker side of the medieval Lady Fortune motif and relates it to Timon in a moral allegory. When the wheel shifts, Timon's followers perceive his distress, but they still, quote-unquote, let him set down, not one accompanying his declining foot. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 88 through 89. The selfish people in the poet's composition are purely transactional in their estimation of Timon. They save themselves while their benefactor ends up at the base of the hill, ruined by fortune's caprice. What does the painter think of this? Not much. He says there are plenty of allegorical paintings that could give us the same lesson in one view. People will save their own skins at any cost. He sees no need to go into the matter further by, say, reflecting on his own relations with Timon. For that matter, the poet himself seems disinclined to engage in inconvenient introspection about the need for human beings to observe loyalty and humility. He just wants Timon's patronage, which comes down to money. The poet says with respect to Timon that, quote-unquote, his large fortune, upon his good and gracious nature hanging, subdues and properties to his love and tendance all sorts of hearts. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 56 through 59. There is a hint, in such language, of something other than the innocent spirit in which Timon sees himself acting when he spreads largesse among his fellow Athenians. In Timon's unrestricted giving, we may discover a drive to dominate others with a smile, to condition them to one's will. This drive to assert one's superiority is part of what we might call Timonomics. But at this point, none of Timon's followers worry about any defects there might be in his sunny ideology. They are consorting with Timon because they want to sell him things, not to reflect deeply on economic theory, Timon's nature, or his future well-being. Timon, too, for all his philosophizing, remains oblivious to a great deal that he should consider. We catch our first glimpse of him when he's doing something characteristic, helping everyone who asks. He rescues Ventidius, who has been arrested for his debts, and easily gives in to the old Athenian who professes to be irate that one of Timon's servants, Lucilius wants to marry his daughter. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 96 through 111, and lines 112 through 153 inclusive. He that loves to be flattered is worthy of the flatterer. Timon and friends dine with Apemantus the cynic. Still in Act 1, Scene 1, Apemantus the cynic philosopher puts in an appearance. The cynics reject an emphasis on wealth and fine manners, among other things, as being unnatural. In his mocking way, Apemantus tries to impart some wisdom to Timon and his guests, declaring that Timon is no better than those who flatter him. Quote unquote, "He that loves to be flattered is worthy of the flatterer." Act 1, Scene 1, line 219. Aside from that, the sum of Apemantus's purpose seems to be to confirm that, quote unquote, "the strain of man's bred out into baboon and monkey." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 243 through 244. Ever the observer, Apemantus has come to the feast mainly, he says, quote unquote, "to see meat fill knaves and wine heat fools." Act 1, Scene 1, line 253. Having announced his portfolio as a sour cynic philosopher among the beautiful people, Apemantus is through with the lords at Timon's feast, at least until dinner is served, when he gets another chance to shine forth in all his acerbity. There's none can truly say he gives if he receives. Timon again unfolds to present company his notions about wealth and friendship. In Act 1, Scene 2, Timon asserts his utopian personal philosophy. It consists of a social circle grounded in the continual exchanging of mostly symbolic, very expensive gifts that unite its members in friendship. But in practice, Timon is the one bestowing the gifts. There's nothing reciprocal about his relationships. His so-called friends pay him with flattery and use him as an easy mark for their overpriced commodities, and he rewards them all the more. When Ventidius tries to repay Timon, if he is even serious about it, the latter turns down the repayment, saying, quote unquote, "there's none can truly say he gives if he receives." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 10 through 11. Timon does not see giving in economic terms. He sees it through a veil of idealism. To him, it's an expression of generous friendship. Taking anything in return would cancel out the good intentions involved in the original act of giving. It seems to be a principal tenet of Timonomics that chickens never come home to roost. Timon's gloss on ceremony is presented to us when his guests make a decorous response to his generosity toward Ventidius, only to be told, quote unquote, "ceremony was but devised at first to set a gloss on faint deeds, hollow welcomes, recanting goodness, sorry ere 'tis shown." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 16 through 18. It's entirely possible for decorum, ceremony, and the like to degenerate into hollow, dishonest formalism. But Timon's dismissal seems peremptory and overly broad, all but inviting his guests to take advantage of him. Appreciation of formalities was not so despised in Shakespeare's own time. The strangeness of Timon's conception of friendship appears when he says, quote unquote, "Why, I have often wished myself poorer, that I might come nearer to you. We are born to do benefits." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 95 through 97. Never mind immediate reciprocity. Timon would rather widen the arc of giving and receiving, wishing that someday, who knows when, he might have need of his friend's generosity, just so they may take the same pleasure in giving that he enjoys, and grow even closer to him. Obviously, this is poppycock. Hamlet's Polonius makes more sense when he says, quote unquote, "neither a borrower nor a lender be." Timon may not understand it, but his so-called friends know that their only real tie to him is what Marx called the cash nexus. There's nothing deep or mystical about it. When Timon stress tests his friendships, he will see them fail as quickly as fatigued metal. Trying to transcend the spirit-controlling power of money by giving others enormous sums of the stuff as a way of backfiring. Men shut their doors against a setting sun. Apamantus tries to warn Timon of his coming ruin, but a princely mask distracts the wealthy lord and his guests. In Act 1, Scene 2, after an extravagant Amazonian mask concludes and the lords rise from the dinner table to dance with the actors, Apamantus utters the lovely but somber thought, quote unquote, "Men shut their doors against a setting sun." Act 1, Scene 2, line 138. But the impact of this line falls only upon us. Inside the play, it drops to no effect amid so much good cheer. Apamantus sees all the entertainment as vanity. He finds in it no harmony or decent purpose, and in such pleasures no healing for the soul. A similar fate befalls Apamantus's blunt question, quote unquote, "What needs these feasts, pomps, and vainglories?" Act 1, Scene 2, lines 240 through 241. The cynic philosopher seems determined to warn Timon about the danger he's in, but his mingled mockery and advice falls on inattentive ears. Apamantus sums up his assessment of Timon and the second scene as well with what sounds like a heartfelt remark, quote unquote, "Oh, that men's ears should be to counsel deaf, but not to flattery." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 246 through 247. To show him what a beggar his heart is, the honest steward Flavius agonizes over his inability to get through to the spendthrift Timon. Still in Act 1, Scene 2, the honest steward Flavius rehearses his agonized recognition of his master's blindness to impending ruin in the form of, quote unquote, "an empty coffer." Act 1, Scene 2, line 190. The trouble is, he rehearses it only to himself. As yet, he has been unable or unwilling to introduce the matter to Timon. As the French proverb runs, quote unquote, "no man is a hero to his valet." But while Flavius sees Timon's disastrous incapacity with managing either his money or his hangers-on, he clearly honors the man's good intentions and is loath to drag him down to reality. Timon will not, laments Flavius, quote unquote, "know his purse or yield me this to show him what a beggar his heart is, being of no power to make his wishes good." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 191 through 193. In modern times, we sometimes joke about the very rich being so wealthy that they have no idea how much money they have. That seems to be literally true of Timon of Athens. For the moment, Timon is too busy enjoying his utopian circle of admirers and dependents to pay attention to Apamantus's barbed wisdom, and he has apparently rebuffed his steward's attempts to tell him the truth. But Shakespeare seldom allows utopian visions to go unchallenged. There's no such thing as a flawless human system. In real life, there's no utopia, no perfect society. Just when, quote unquote, "you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction," as Barry McGuire's 1965 anthem of American political apocalypse goes, you're probably on your way there and farther along than you think. For Shakespeare, human beings are ineradicably post-lapsarian. They live in the aftermath of the fall, and as the wise clown Feste says in Twelfth Night, "anything that's mended is but patched." That's from Act 1, Scene 5, line 40 of Twelfth Night. Timon's main problem is that he does not have a realistic understanding of human nature, and he does not understand himself or his relationships with other human beings. While he is far from ignoble, no sustainable good can come of his philosophy of flattery as friendship, and extreme giving. Generous excess is a principle that Shakespeare considers vital because it opposes the varieties of cruel excess to which people are distressingly willing to sink whenever it's convenient. All the same, generosity is not to be showered on human predators who show contempt for the person who bestows it. To the wicked, kindness plays out as weakness, and even to the merely amoral, it is a thing to be exploited, not honored. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Sunday, June 8th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.